Hi, Warwick Jones here from RMIT on Woi Wurrung Country. If you've listened to Making a Difference before, welcome back. If you haven't, Making a Difference is a Junction journalism podcast produced by journalism students like myself from universities around Australia. In this episode, we'll bring you stories about two different communities struggling to get vaccinated for two very different reasons. We'll explore how to tackle misinformation in different communities, and we'll speak to a journalist who works one of the hardest beats in the business. Our first story, though, is from reporter Sarah Oliver. Sarah investigated an issue that's become a humanitarian disaster overseas. Prisons everywhere in the world are dealing with coronavirus outbreaks, and we knew this was going to happen. Some prisoners were even released early for that very reason. But I think a lot of people have forgotten prisoners in this pandemic, which could be a really big problem, because as Sarah points out, it won't just be the inmates who go down if that ship sinks.
So, Warwick, when I was looking into this story, I talked to Dr. Talia Anthony, who's a professor of law at the University of Technology in Sydney, and she told me how in late 2019 she'd organised
a prison visit in New South Wales, and it was at the time of the bushfires.
And they needed to evacuate the prison.
And the first response was to evacuate the staff.
Wow.
And Talia's quite worried that the same thing is going to happen with the pandemic.
Okay, so Sarah, what did happen in prisons last year when COVID reached Australia?
Well, I guess kind of luckily for us, it was really ramping up overseas. So before it hit our shores, it gave us time to prepare for what was to come and also gave us an insight into how the virus was affecting prisons. Maria Smith, who's the CEO of the Victorian Association for the Care and Resettlement of Offenders, or VACRO for short, was watching the virus unfold in prisons overseas.
It was an incredible time, because things were changing weekly, really. And the data from overseas was showing that prisons were very vulnerable to the virus. It was really running rampant in prisons in Europe and the United States.
And prisoners were getting sick and dying. In the US alone, over 2,500 prisoners have died since April last year, and that number is still rising.
There's been a spike in coronavirus cases at San Quentin State Prison.
Sparked an explosion of COVID cases behind prison walls.
There have been more than 2,000 cases of COVID among inmates. And
we treat people in prison as though their lives don't matter, and I fear that this will be the same with the vaccine.
I think maybe it's worth taking a step back here, because some people might think that vaccinating prisoners shouldn't really be a priority. I mean, many Australians haven't been vaccinated, some still aren't eligible to be vaccinated. So why is it important for prisoners to get vaccinated?
It's super important. You know, prisoners are among some of the most vulnerable people in our society because of the close proximity with other prisoners.
We know that on average, prisons in Australia are overcrowded. They're beyond 100% capacity.
So there's going to be huge numbers of COVID. You're going to have people dying.
And you also really have to consider the Indigenous Australians in prison. They make up about 30% of the prison population in Australia, despite being only 3% of the Australian population, which actually makes them the most incarcerated people in the world.
And what makes Indigenous Australians more vulnerable to COVID-19?
Well, they've got a higher rate of pre-existing conditions, which makes it more likely for them to get really sick and die. But also, vaccinating the vulnerable first really is the best way to prevent another outbreak.
Prisons are much more a part of the community than people perhaps understand. Any prison has hundreds of staff members coming in and out every day.
So if a staff member in a prison were to get infected and they came home, they could give it to their family, then spread it further. You know, there's trucks and delivery people coming in and out of prisons. What if COVID got onto food or laundry or something? Because we know how COVID really attaches onto so much stuff. It's not just people. That could then spread into the community even further.
So it's not a case that you can just shut them off and then not worry about them. That, to me, by the way, would be an unacceptable position, but it's also not a realistic position.
Okay, so Sarah, considering that prisons house this very vulnerable population, and an outbreak in a prison would be really difficult to contain, what's been done to keep COVID out of Australian prisons?
So prisons implemented a mandatory 14-day isolation for new prisoners.
So anyone arriving to a prison from the community, so they're arrested and then they're put in prison for the first time, had to undergo a 14-day quarantine period.
And that really worked. In Victoria, there were only around 30 cases detected in prison quarantine and all were asymptomatic.
So you'd have to conclude that if they hadn't have set up this quarantine, COVID would have got in, and we know from overseas what that looks like.
The other thing they did was they stopped face-to-face visits in prison for personal visits or for services, like with their lawyers or other prison services. So because of that, they brought in some smart tablets for prisoners to use in order to call those people.
But that actual physical touch, being able to see people and spend time with people, is incredibly important. And it was something that was missed throughout the pandemic. So you had every prisoner in Victoria not have a personal visit from their loved one for basically a year. And that was a huge sacrifice that they made during that period.
So now that the virus is under control in Australia and life on the outside has returned pretty much to normal, what do prisons look like?
Not that different, really. Some prisons are allowing face-to-face visits again, but there's still restrictions on those visits.
Why is it still restrictive around visiting prisoners?
I guess it's to, you know, stop any chance of transmission, which could be seen as overcautious. I mean, we're seeing music festivals, bars and cafes are open. People are going to the footy. You know, there's tens of thousands of people going to those games. But if it's not being overcautious, then they're saying prisoners are at risk, which means they really should just be getting vaccinated.
Mm.
And early on last year, reports said that prisoners would be among the first to be vaccinated, presumably for that reason. But it just hasn't happened. Staff are being vaccinated as part of the 1B phase rollout, but as far as we know, prisoners aren't.
And what will happen if we don't vaccinate prisoners?
Well, there's absolutely still a possibility of a resurgence in cases. And as we've seen, that would increase the likelihood of an outbreak in prisons. And if that were to happen, it would be devastating for the prison population.
Mm.
But also, as I've said, we can't separate prisons from society.
Prisons are part of the community. And if you think about a lot of towns in Victoria, like Ararat and Beechworth, for example, these are towns where the prison is a significant part of the community. A lot of the community members work in the prison or live with people who work in the prison, socialise with people who work in the prison.
So if an outbreak were to occur in a prison, it could leak into general society.
Prisons experience the outbreaks much more severely. And that then feeds into or spills over into society.
And it's also important to note how prisoners, although have committed some sort of crime, they are still deserving of their basic human rights, which includes healthcare, which clearly at the moment they're not receiving.
Yeah.
There's this really great quote that goes, "You can judge a society by how they treat their prisoners."
Mm.
And I guess if this is how we're treating them, what does that say about us?
As a society, we often regard prisons as these enclaves that are separate to society, and we define the people inside prisons as separate to our own humanity, which helps to justify keeping people in these horrible segregated conditions.
But also, to put it kind of practically, there was a survey done last year by Deadly Connections that found the suspension of face-to-face visits was the most common reason for a decline in mental health. And studies have also shown that a decline in mental health can really impact badly on rehabilitation of prisoners.
Mm.
And prisoners' rehabilitation really does affect our society too. And we could really get into that if you wanted to, but yeah.
How long have you got?
Yeah. Might be here for a while.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Warwick.
That was reporter Sarah Oliver speaking with me in the studio earlier. Our next story is also about vaccines, but this time it's not about people who've been forgotten, but rather people who've been misled. Australia's Muslim community often seek advice from faith leaders, and coronavirus is no different. But faith leaders aren't always the best qualified person to give advice. And in this pandemic, accurate information is more important than ever. Reporter Shamsia Hussain-Poor is a member of Melbourne's Muslim community, and she spoke to a sheikh who's fighting to combat misinformation.
When it comes to religion and science, there has always been some sort of conflict of how one weighs more than the other. And this is probably why many faith members of the community have turned towards faith leaders for advice or signs of what to do and where to go regarding the misinformation on COVID-19 vaccines.
Often we go to a religious leader, to a sheikh, because we have a decision to be made on something that we can't understand or is beyond our comprehension. And so it's out of respect that we'd seek their judgment or advice.
Tasneem Chopra, a cross-cultural consultant who also works at the Department of Health and the COVID Response Unit, is concerned about people seeking advice from faith leaders regarding this issue.
When we're seeking advice about whether to pursue a medical procedure or a medical course of action, that's not the skill set of the sheikh. They're not medically qualified, unless they happen to be a doctor, or in this case, an infectious disease specialist and a sheikh, which I have not yet come across, then I think fine. But to be seeking medical knowledge from a sheikh when you have uncertainty about issue is, in my estimation, a wrong move to make.
Mrs. Chopra says the matter is always complex because not everyone understands science.
Often in communities, people might rely on a figurehead or someone prominent for their information source. And while that's well intended, it can be misguided. And what I mean by that is, if your car breaks down, you wouldn't go to a florist. You'd go to a mechanic. If you needed a bunch of flowers, you wouldn't go to a surgeon. You'd go to a florist.
So when there is a lot of contradicting information going around, it causes confusion.
So you have to be conscious about who you're seeking your information from. And just because someone has a loud voice doesn't mean they're always right. Just because someone is popular or high standing in the community doesn't necessarily mean they have the scientific background and the medical skills or qualifications to make a statement.
There are many conspiracy theories going around in the community, especially now for Muslims since it's Ramadan. Some are arguing that COVID is all hoax, while others are spreading misinformation about the vaccines and how unsafe it is. This is where faith leaders have stepped in.
The first principle we apply in Islam is that, as Allah Azza wa Jalla commands us, don't use information unless you know how valid that information is. I advise people to go to the sources of the information and get the information from the right places.
While Mrs. Chopra is concerned with people choosing faith leaders over medical professions to seek advice, Abdunur Wali, an imam from the Islamic Council Victoria, is more concerned about the fact that people come to him not to seek advice, but to convince him that the misinformation is somewhat true.
The issue is people don't think they have misinformation. They think they have the right information and they try to convince you that they have the right information.
During the pandemic, the number of worshippers decreased, but in the holy month of Ramadan, the numbers were doubled again. People attended mosques not only to worship, but also to break their fast with the rest of the community. Faith members like Imam Wali took this opportunity to remind people about the purpose of Ramadan, and that is avoiding gossip and preaching nothing but the truth, in hope to help people rethink about their misinformed judgment about the vaccines.
Contributing to the misinformation, it's a serious problem in our religion. So you may think you are just saying your opinion, but when you're spreading misinformation, whether that is for or against it, that is not right.
Imam Wali is concerned about people's false judgment and says people of faith shouldn't believe what they hear. The Quran teaches people to not only be truthful about what they preach, but also to think and reflect about the things that they preach.
When you read the Quran, Allah always asks us to think, to reflect, to analyze. And that's what I'm asking our community.
Imam Wali advises people to be truthful and seek expert advice instead of believing what people say in chats or groups.
Use your mind. And when you use that reason, get the information from the experts. Don't get the information from the community. Don't get the information from Facebook or from WhatsApp groups.
Imam Wali constantly recites a verse from the Quran as a reminder to people who are confused.
If this is not your field, ask the people who specialize in this area. That's my advice to our community and to everybody who is listening.
That was Imam Abdunur Wali talking to our reporter Shamsia. I'm Warwick, this is Making a Difference. Our next story is also about misinformation, but this time of a very different kind. Millions of Australians are members of a local football club, and these clubs often have a very strong social fabric, which means rumour and gossip are always never far off. Reporter Eli Duxon spoke to people at his local football club about the problem social media poses and how we can apply tools designed to help people verify information to things we hear about other people. So Eli, the pandemic brought local football to a stop, but now that it's up and running again, what does Hillside Football Club look like?
Oh, it's just buzzing. Absolutely buzzing. everyone's pretty much back to playing footy, which is fantastic. And yeah, it's not just Hillside, it's all over Australia. I think the nationwide participation is edging towards the 2 million mark. But Hillside, they play in the Essendon District Football League, which covers the northwest suburbs of Melbourne. And in 2019, they had over 10,000 members.
But not all 10,000 members are playing football. So what does a typical member of a local football club look like, and what's their connection with the club?
You get all kinds of paperwork. Most of the players are children, teenagers, young people, sort of 20 to 30. You get the occasional older player still trying to regain a bit of youth. But yeah, sometimes they're volunteers, committee members, helping out at the bar, just general supporters. A lot of people just love coming to the games, seeing people that they're familiar with and being able to talk to them and share a common bond and hoping that their side gets up.
And a big part of the local football club is social. So what do people talk about?
I think generally the conversations I have with people in this football club, other than football, is what's going on in AFL football, what's going on in the market, the local market. A lot of the players now are starting to buy properties.
That was Charlie Denaro. He's the senior coach at Hillside Football Club, and he's had experience in footy for 40 years now across different states, different leagues, different clubs.
So we'll talk a little bit about that, a little bit about investments, a little bit about, you know, how to spend money, how to save money.
And obviously, they're not all experts in finance or in the housing market. So do we know what sort of misinformation spreads in the local football club?
Yeah, the big one is AFL news. A lot of these people that are at these clubs, they've got some sort of interest in AFL. There's so much on social media nowadays. So for all these members, like, the news is social. And sometimes at these footy clubs, you get rumours about some of the players as well and what's going on in their lives, maybe.
Really? That player did that with that player's girlfriend? Oh, shit, that's crap.
Sometimes there's a little bit of a home truth to it because there's got to be some sort of base for that to spread, but often it's just been taken way out of proportion.
There's a lot of players that get scrutinised and it filters down to our level. The boys talk about it. The boys talk about it all the time. And I think probably the most concerning thing for me, there's a couple of things, but that social media aspect, while we know it's prevalent in the AFL, it's really catching on at local level as well.
I spoke with some local players on whether they've seen these rumours spread from teammates and around the locker rooms.
I've heard a lot of rumours in AFL and just around footy clubs as well.
A lot of guys talk smack and they don't know what they're talking about, or they just heard from a mate, from a mate, from a mate, and none of it is actually really reliable.
Yeah, a few people have sent me stuff like saying this is 100% truth and all that.
Sometimes, you know, stuff gets passed around on social media as well, where you'll see like, oh, this bloke's got a quote and he's taking this as what's authentic and stuff. So it probably goes around, even though it probably never gets validated or verified.
So when false information is passed on unknowingly between these people, that's misinformation.
Yeah.
But when this false information is passed on knowingly, that's disinformation.
So what do these local football club rumours look like?
It can be almost anything and everything you can think of with social media. It's pretty much limited by the creativity of the people spreading it. RMIT ABC Fact Check Chief of Staff Sushi Das says it can vary greatly.
Misinformation and disinformation can both come to us through words, so text, videos, photographs, memes. So it can be visual as well as text.
And with this variation, it just means you get a bigger reach and scope for who this information actually hits.
Do you ever pass information on to your mates that you can't really confirm but think might be true?
Yeah, I'll be honest, sometimes I do. I do get sucked in sometimes to probably some fake news.
There has been stuff that I've passed on to my mates that I was just like, I'm pretty sure it's true. I can't confirm if it's a true fact.
I'd say I would have definitely, if I believe something or if I just hear someone's word for it and I think it's a good story, I'd put my name to it to try and, if it's right, get the satisfaction of saying, yep, I said it first.
Often the false information can include a sort of kernel of truth. So it might be something that is true, but it's reframed so that it's in a slightly different context, which makes it misleading.
And Denaro's seen a decreased support network for a lot of these players. He's got close relationships with these players. That's part of being a coach. When you've got that decreased support network, that just means you get less education on certain topics, and it means people are more likely to get sucked into misinformation.
Sometimes, you know, people just haven't thought about it and they do the usual, you know, scroll, like something, share. And it gets passed around really quickly because you might share something that goes to a group of people and all of the people in that group might then share it again, and you can see how it spreads almost like a virus.
Okay, so what can the boys at the local football club do to limit the amount of misinformation that they spread online?
A lot of it just comes down to thinking about what you're looking at. And Das says we just need to pay more attention, really.
There are some key questions you need to ask. For example, where did this information come from? Who sent it to me? How did it to get there? Who put it there? And what might have motivated that person to put that information there?
And knowing how to answer these questions just comes down to media literacy.
Okay, and what is media literacy?
So media literacy is our ability to navigate information and just determine its quality. And to do that, we need to do lateral reading. So we need to look at the sources and really understand motives and biases from these sources. And Das talks about what motivates that person to put that information there. If we really understand that, then we can understand if there is an agenda or if this is something completely impartial of that.
Whether it's socializing with your friends or making new friends or engaging with government, engaging with our democracy, getting health information, all of those different things require media and media and technology engagement.
That was Dr. Tanya Notley, and she's a senior lecturer at Western Sydney University School of Humanities and Communication Arts.
And does Tanya say that we are teaching media literacy?
So essentially, if you're in primary school or secondary school, you're going to be getting some sort of media literacy education. But if you're an adult, there's not really that education still there to access quite easily.
Yeah, right.
So she thinks that we just need to target them a little bit more directly.
I think that media literacy education for adults has to be delivered online. It has to be delivered via our broadcast media, and it has to be in our communities as well.
So media literacy is one positive step towards shutting down misinformation. But so often, like what we're hearing is not just on social media. People tell us stuff in person. And if you know something is wrong when someone's telling you something, just be empathetic.
Mm.
Be empathetic in telling the person that that is misinformation, because we've all done it. We're all human. We're going to make errors from time to time. But the better we can be as verifiers of misinformation, the better we can combat it. And particularly in local footy clubs, I think that's a super important thing.
Thanks, Eli.
No worries, Rock. Cheers.
Again, that was our reporter Eli in conversation with me. And finally, we'll bring you a conversation between reporter Charlotte Huston and John Sylvester, a journalist from The Age, about the psychological impact of crime reporting on journalists like himself.
John Sylvester is Australia's longest-serving crime reporter. He currently writes a weekly column for The Age in conjunction with his podcast, Naked City.
So, John, during my research for this interview, I discovered there was a lack of information or data on the psychological toll of crime reporting. Do you find this surprising at all?
It's a profession that doesn't spend much time in introspection because you're after the next story. And a lot of areas where there's trauma, that's the best example probably is first responders. Let's talk about police.
Mm-hmm.
The police are much more advanced in the area of mental health for a good reason, and that is it's often cradle to the grave of employment. You join as a constable and you continue on. So if somebody gets a mental illness and they go off work, there's a liability. In journalism, it's much more transient. So there's far fewer people. It's very rare now to have somebody who starts working in an organisation and continues through a whole career. You don't have people who work 40 years for one organisation. So even though the bosses talk about mental health, underlying is the fact that it's, you know, subconsciously, it's someone else's problem. Now, if you are the best at doing an intrusion, if you are the best at dealing with somebody in stress, I'll send you to the job. There was an example at The Age where there was a really, really good reporter, and she still is. And she was big and loud, funny, swore like a trooper. But that was a bit of a shield, and that underneath she was quite a sensitive person, but she was really good at getting people to talk, and she was going again and again and again on these jobs. And I went to her then boss and said, you just can't keep doing this. She's getting the results, but the long term, where's she going to be in 5 years' time? And you can see the look was, well, I won't be here, she won't be here, but this story I need today. So it's the urgent takes the place of the important. In policing, you might work on a task force for a period of time and then move out into something else.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to keep people in the position as long as they're kicking goals.
Mm-hmm.
They play full forward now. But in crime reporting, there are few people who do it forever. It's a really good starting point, and you can dip in and dip out. And I'm one of the few who've enjoyed it so much I've stuck with it, and I don't regret that.
Mm-hmm.
Crime reporting is no different to lots of the stressful areas, but stress is pretty simple. It's a bucket, and everyone's bucket is bigger or smaller, but everyone's got a bucket. Doesn't mean you're better or worse, and that bucket can be filled up with one incident. Bourke Street, the young reporters who ran down there and saw so much trauma, that can fill the bucket. Or it can be the drip, drip, drip of a deadline, or drip, drip, drip of just seeing such sad things all the time. So you need holes in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be hobbies, family, fun, whatever. But you need relief so it doesn't build up and spill over.
Mm-hmm. So you regularly appear on 3AW radio, and you have your weekly podcast, Naked City. Do you find it cathartic to speak with other people about your experiences as a crime reporter?
I enjoy what I do, and there's an element of black humour, which is something that's developed by a lot of people in journalism, nursing. It's nothing unique, and it's how to deal with it. I spoke to a forensic expert who spent so much time dealing with bodies and trauma. I said, "How do you do it?" And he said, "It's as long as you believe what you're doing matters, you can deal with it. The day you think it doesn't matter is the day you're overwhelmed." So if it's just a tsunami of sad stories, or a tsunami as a police officer of dealing with the desperate, the dangerous and the bewildered, and you think, "I'm not making any difference," that's when you get overwhelmed.
Do you believe, with the nature of crime reporting and its heightened drama and violent tendencies, and as you mentioned, with the increased technology that you can be exposed to it far more, do you think that's deterred journalists from entering the field?
I'd hope not, because it's cops and robbers. It's the best job in town. That's why I do it. And when I go and speak to a group of people like you at RMIT, it's just incredibly energising, because if at any time you get old and cynical, you look up and you see a couple of hundred pairs of eyes and people who look at you, and they would kill for your job.
That was John Sylvester speaking with Charlotte Huston, and that's all. For more stories from Making a Difference, go to our website, junctionjournalism.com. This episode was produced by me and RMIT University on Woi Wurrung Country. See ya.